From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a thing on.
Donald Trump finally got his briefing on Russian involvement in the presidential election, and Republicans are getting hesitant about repealing Obamacare. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh, national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine and MSNBC analyst. Our special guest is Steve Clemens. He's editor-at-large of The Atlantic. Welcome, everybody. Donald Trump got an intelligence briefing about the email hacks of political operations around Hillary Clinton on Friday. But hours before he got the briefing, he declared to the New York Times that the discussion around Russian interference in the presidential election is a, quote, political witch hunt designed to undermine the perceived legitimacy of his presidency. Earlier in the week, he tweeted that the briefing had been suspiciously delayed, perhaps for a lack of evidence. Intelligence community sources told various news organizations that the briefing had always been scheduled for Friday and was not delayed at all. Before we proceed, I should note something about my personal relationship to this story. My fiancé is a political operative, and a large number of his emails were released in the hack. Steve, I want to start with you. A key theme, as Trump has talked about this story, is basically that the intelligence community has gotten a lot of important things wrong in recent years and is too politicized. Now, it's quite unusual for a president-elect to say something like that out loud. How's that going to affect his ability to work with intelligence as president when he's overseeing the agencies producing these reports?
It's going to create huge problems for him as he takes any international action, whether it's on North Korea, whether it's confronting China, because the intelligence community, in both with warts and with its strength, is his antenna to the world. It is his way to gather information and to make informed decisions. And they have made mistakes before. I think Admiral Mike Rogers, during the hearings in the Senate, said it's appropriate to be skeptical at every point of this, to double-check things. And that's why there are these norms. There's a complicated dance that goes on between the 17 different intelligence agencies we have in government before they synthesize their decisions. But when you look at it, and I have covered intelligence issues for many, many years, when you look at the specificity of these claims and how they've grown, how elements of this reporting has been shared with both Democrats with a lot of solvency in national security issues, as well as Republicans on Capitol Hill, it's just Donald Trump has carved out a place in this debate, which is remarkable because he's essentially telling the national security leadership in both parties, as well as in his own executive branch of government, to take a flying leap. So that is going to upend his ability to work with them in the future, in my view.
Joan, is there anything unnerving about the way the left has lined up with the intelligence community here? It's been sort of interesting. You had this hearing this week on in the Senate with Democratic senators, really standing up for the community here. Just a few months ago, they were in this big fight over sharing of information with the intelligence committees in the Senate, trying to resist oversight. Historically, there's been a lot of skepticism about the power of these agencies on the left. Should they be skeptical more than they are here?
I think people have been pretty skeptical. I mean, I think this is part of why it didn't become a huge issue before the election. A lot of us look back and think, and President Obama thinks, we all should have been talking about it more, including people on the left. I think there was appropriate skepticism, but I think what Steve says is true. When you have all of these agencies, which often battle and bicker and, vie for primacy, when you have all these agencies agreeing, you have to pay attention. So I think we can do two things at the same time. We can be skeptical of a lot of things. We cannot want them to have too much power, and yet we can pay attention to what they all seem to agree is true. And also, again, filtering what our president and our congressional leaders believe, knowing what they have seen is true, what they're telling us. It's not just taking the intelligence agencies' point of view. It's taking our political leaders who we voted for and still presumably support, their point of view.
Rich, in some very simple way, what Donald Trump says about the politics of the story is true, which is that one of the reasons that Democrats are eager to talk about it is that it is quite embarrassing for Donald Trump and for Republicans if people come to the conclusion that the Russian government played a role in getting him elected. And Paul Ryan echoed that view this week, even though Ryan, unlike Trump, doesn't seem to have significant doubt about the intelligence conclusions here. And I guess the question is, what do you do if you're in that position where there is a fact or a strong inference that hurts you politically? And you sort of, is there a reasonable way to say, well, yeah, this is true, but we shouldn't talk about it so much?
Yeah, well, I think that's basically what Paul Ryan said at his news conference when he's asked about this, and it just doesn't seem very complicated. You admit the facts, and look, there should always be, you know, a grain of salt about intelligence, because intelligence isn't necessarily stone-cold facts. You put together various dots, and there are various assumptions involved, but this seems a conclusion that seems very well-founded. So you just do what Paul Ryan says. You look, it seems clear the Russians interfered with the election. That's appalling. We should investigate it. But Donald Trump won, and he won for all sorts of reasons, and this wasn't necessarily decisive. I mean, that doesn't seem hard to do, but Trump just refuses to do it because he thinks it's going to be a taint on his victory, and it's caught up in questions of his manhood and his honor, and he's just doubling down on rejecting the evidence.
Steve, some of the conclusions from this report, after the report was made to the president on Thursday before it got to Donald Trump on Friday, and some of the conclusions from the report ended up in the Washington Post and then with NBC News, and Donald Trump on Friday tweeted that the House and Senate intelligence committees ought to look into how that information got out. What do you make of that? I mean, presumably we don't want leaks of these sorts. You shouldn't have selective political leaks. On the other hand, I think a lot of people, especially in the media, look very warily at the idea that you're going to have the president going around telling the congressional intel committees to look into leaks that are damaging to him politically.
Well, it's the irony of ironies, because some of us, when WikiLeaks exposed its first information and came out, were kind of chuckling that this is a journalistic leveler. Friends of mine like Eli Lake and others are saying, you know, now David Sanger at the New York Times won't be the only one who gets these leaks, that you actually are able to look across a lot of platforms in government, and anybody can see this. And not that we were advocating what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks did, but, you know, look at the irony of this. This is Donald Trump hugging publicly Julian Assange and everything that comes in WikiLeaks, but the MSNBC and Post come up with something out of this, and he's ready to go to battle over that. So he's full of inconsistencies, and I think Rich just laid it out, that there's an element of a kind of bravado, a manhood battle that goes on in each one of the iterations in these battles. And I think, unfortunately, many of us don't feel, or I don't feel, that that's very presidential, but it's going to be part of the terrain that we live in. I think journalism is going to continue to try to seek from government, to keep government accountable, to sort of look and get what it can, how it can. And we have protections for the press here in this country, and Donald is going to have to learn to live with that.
As I watch this episode, the thing that scares me is basically the Donald Trump's willingness to make up his own reality. There was even a story this week about when he was hosting The Apprentice and the ratings had slipped and were not that great, and they were, you know, the 72nd most watched show on broadcast TV, and he would insist that they should put out statements about how they're winning the time slot even when they're not. I just wonder about his ability to oversee this apparatus, to respond when it brings him news that he doesn't want because it's politically inconvenient, because it says negative things about his friends, and then what impact that's going to have on the people who provide this research, and to the extent that it will end up coming to him saying what he wants it to say. I mean, he wouldn't be the first president whose preferences about what the intelligence said affected what the intelligence said,
sure.
But I think it could be much more severe than it's been in the past.
I think it's going to be, but I also think there's just going to be, like, you know, some people don't like WikiLeaks, some people don't like other leaks. There's just going to be like it's going to be a sieve, because people are going to be leaking wildly because they can't necessarily trust their information getting to him or him reacting to their information. I mean, we actually saw this to some extent with the FBI and with Comey. I mean, I think that James Comey came out and made the statement about finding the new Anthony Weiner emails because right-wing elements in the FBI were ready to leak the fact that those emails existed. So, I mean, we are living with the, you know, with the real consequences of partisan leaking on both sides, and I don't know how we get used to this new normal, but it's what journalists have to cope with.
I think he's pretty good at compartmentalizing, and he'll be able to absorb and take on intelligence about most other matters. I wouldn't draw big conclusions necessarily about this particular incident, which involves his victory and his manhood. But the problem is, what if he's extremely personally vested in some foreign policy conflict down the road?
Right.
And then he doesn't want to hear what the intelligence agencies have to say and creates his own
reality.
That's the disturbing scenario.
I mean, I think that's what we're asking about Russia right now. I mean,
right.
In Cleveland, in the floor, when they were having a battle over the Republican platform, it was remarkable to see how disinterested the Trump team was in that platform, with the exception of one provision which they successfully got removed, which was a condemnation of Russia over Ukraine and a calling for action over Crimea. I interviewed Senator Tom Cotton that day about that incident, and he wasn't aware of that, but he made the statement that once Donald Trump was read in on Russia, he would change his views on Russia. And I think it raises an interesting question that you say is that there are a lot of national security conservatives who take America's place in the world seriously. They take the size and capabilities of the Pentagon seriously, and they look at the threats that are evolving out there. And when one looks at the Trump team's focus on Russia and a kind of, you know, those of us that also kind of understand communications are somewhat surprised that Donald Trump hasn't come out and said, you know, I won this election fair and square, but damn you, Russia, for skewing the mix. Why hasn't he come out and stood up and both claimed his presidency and condemned the Russians? That would be easy to do, and it would sweep, I think, through middle America and centrists, frankly, and say, thank God he sees it that way. But the fact that he doesn't gets right to what Rich was just saying. There is a suspicion because of behavior and because of not just this event but other events that there's something deeper on the Russia question that doesn't make sense, and we're all pondering what that is.
You see, I think there's a simpler explanation of that, which is that I think Donald Trump has a bizarre obsession with reciprocity, and that if you say nice things about him, you do nice things for him, then he says nice things about you. Putin praised him, was supposed to have said that he was clever, but it sounds like maybe Putin really said he was colorful and there was a mistranslation from the Russian. Putin seems to have done him a solid with this stuff, even if Trump is publicly denying that he believes the Russians were involved in this. It's like in, what was it, the second debate, where each candidate was asked to say something nice about each other. And Hillary Clinton said something about how Donald Trump has nice children. It was sort of the least she could do to say something nice. And Donald Trump comes back and says she works really hard and is tireless, which was counter to everything Trump had been saying about how she lacked stamina and was tired.
She sleeps all the time.
Right. And so it was, you know, why did he do that? Because it was reciprocity. Hillary said something nice about his family. He had to say something nice about her. So I think my thought is that he can't bring himself to break with Putin because Putin's been good to him, and it's just what personal moral code he has here is that he feels like he owes Putin one.
I respect your point of view, but I just think that's too simple. I really do think that there are deeper connections here, going back to the platform fight that didn't exist on anything else except that one issue. Going back to to Manafort, to picking Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. I mean, I think there are deep reciprocity issues of profit, of power. It's beyond just he praised him, so he's going to be nice to him.
I accept your explanation, Josh, until I see hard evidence otherwise. Because it makes sense.
Right.
You know, this is the way he operates pretty much with everyone. But maybe there's something else more there. We just don't know.
Steve, I want to ask you quickly about one thing before we go to break, which is one thing that people around Trump have been talking about doing is significantly reducing the size of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. So basically, this was a post-September 11th thing where you have all these different intelligence agencies. And the thought in the aftermath of September 11th was they didn't talk to each other enough, they weren't coordinated enough, so we created this office over them. The office has expanded, and now the view of a lot of the Trump people seems to be basically that we went too far, it needs to go back the other way, that office is too big, too bureaucratic. A lot of people have been looking at this suspiciously because of the troubled interactions that Trump has been having with the intelligence community overall. Is this a reform that people should be skeptical of, or is this actually a good idea from the Trump people?
I think reform is a good idea in general, and I actually praised Donald Trump the other day for actually suggesting that we may need to do this, and I referred people to Dana Priest's excellent series in the Washington Post called Top Secret America that went into the, you know, enormous size and scale and growth and just sort of the lack of accountability and oversight any longer in the broad intelligence services. I myself think that that organizing the Office of the Director of National Intelligence is the wrong place to start. I thought that was the needed piece in our intelligence infrastructure because you needed to create greater consistency and less overlap between many of the other departments that are out there because they're just sprawling and unbelievably expensive and all over the place. And I also think that, you know, part of what came up in these hearings the other day was whether or not the National Security Agency and the U.S. Cyber Command should be separated and put in. So the idea of reform and thinking through this and whether we're achieving, you know, the intelligence bang for our buck is a smart thing to do. To hit the Director of National Intelligence as the place to start looking like it is political retribution is the wrong way to do it.
Let us know what you think about Trump and intelligence on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, repeal and delay is delayed. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Joan Walsh of The Nation magazine. And Steve Clemens of The Atlantic is also with us. Republican leaders in the House and Senate have been moving toward a strategy on Obamacare called repeal and delay. That is, use the budget process to pass a repeal of much of the law now, but delay the effectiveness of that repeal for a few years and try, in the meantime, to come to some agreement on some replacement. This approach has a number of problems. One is that health insurers, many of whom have already stopped selling plans in Obamacare exchanges in various markets because they've been losing a lot of money, might exit the program altogether as they expect it to end soon and be starved of financial support in the meantime. There also isn't clear agreement among Republicans on what a replacement should be and how it should achieve the difficult promises of reducing public and private costs without taking away coverage. And just Republicans wouldn't be enough. A full replacement would have to clear a 60-vote threshold in the Senate, meaning some Democrats would have to get on board with the changes. So given all those difficulties, four Senate Republicans have now spoken up and said Obamacare shouldn't be repealed until a replacement is ready. They're an interesting group. They're across the ideological spectrum. You have moderate Susan Collins, libertarian Rand Paul, Tom Cotton, who's quite conservative, and Bob Corker, who's one of the most establishment figures within the Republican caucus in the Senate. Now, if all four of them stand firm that repeal must come with replace, that will mean that we can't do repeal and delay. We're going to have to figure out what the new thing is before we can get rid of the old thing. Now, Donald Trump also tweeted a warning this week, telling Republicans not to create a situation where they get blamed for the mess in the healthcare market. So, Rich, where does this leave Republicans? Particularly, what do you make of Donald Trump sort of tiptoeing in here saying, don't break this thing so you can be blamed for it?
Well, I wish he'd just be more explicit and just in a tweet say, don't repeal it until you have a replacement. And that would take care of the strategic question immediately. And he said in a couple interviews that replace should go along with repeal. And he talked to his policy people, and that's what they think. So that would decide the strategic question. Then you'd have the policy question, which is difficult. What we would like to see Republicans do is take the subsidy in Obamacare and effectively deregulate it and say you can use it to buy any insurance plan that's approved by a state regulator with just one condition that if all plans have to honor it, if you've had continuous insurance coverage, you premiums can't spike because you're sick. And this would really effectively wipe out the federal regulations. It would still enable people to buy health insurance and avoid the problem that Republicans are looking at now, which is if they keep going down this road, they're going to get a CBO score that says you're knocking 18 million people or something off of health insurance. Donald Trump will be asked about that at some point in an interview, and there's some good chance you'd say, no, I don't support that. And if they send that to my desk, I'll veto it, which would be a complete debacle out of the gate. So at the very least, they should settle on what they're going to do and have a clear plan of what it is before they stumble into that sort of problem.
Steve, you know, we've sort of watched Republicans talk about this issue for 7 years, and basically they could agree that they didn't like the law, they wanted to repeal the law. They floated a number of plans that are fleshed out to varying degrees. It seems like they had to know that this day would come eventually where they'd run the government and they'd be expected to actually do something. Do you see a map forward to them actually coalescing around something that they will do?
No, I don't. I mean, regrettably, because I think that what has happened is they've developed a habit in the House of Representatives of passing, you know, how many repeals of Obamacare? I mean, it was a sort of a ritualistic vote. What they didn't do is really put their heads together in what would be a compelling alternative. What Rich just shared is very compelling. It would be very interesting to sort of look at some of the problems and hiccups in Obamacare and come in and fill those gaps so that the goal wasn't to remove coverage from some Americans, but actually to create greater flexibility and nimbleness in the system and even broaden participation potentially from that point forward. So I think one of the great ironies is that the individual mandate, to some degree, started with some conservatives. It was pinned on people like Hillary Clinton, but it was other folks like John Chafee and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Romney and others that had early on. The Cato Institute had actually been a place that had talked about universal coverage at one point and looking at a mandate like that being the only way to do it. And it was ironically, or even go back to Richard Nixon, it was Ted Kennedy that undid it. The left had a different direction. So there's an awful lot of thought leadership, classic thought leadership within Republican GOP circles on health care on the shelves that they could come back and take off and sort of work with. But I think that there's just too much diversity of thought to bring it together.
Joan, I think it's pretty clear that the way Democrats plan to handle this is to stand back and say, Republicans, your turn, you have fun, and then blame them for whatever happens. And politically, that makes a fair amount of sense, and especially given the emptiness of what Republicans have said, I understand why that's where they land. But there are a lot of real discontents with the healthcare status quo right now under the Affordable Care Act. People are upset about premiums that they see as too high, out-of-pocket costs that are too high. The law doesn't cover as many people as it was expected to, partly because people don't want to pay those high premiums. So as Republicans sort of look around and say, oh, no, we can't figure out how to do this, we have to get some Democrats involved, is there any opportunity here for Democrats to look at that and say, well, those things are real problems and let's try to find some way to fix them?
You know, I wish there was, but I don't think so. And I don't think it's going to come from the Democrats. I mean, I think it has to come from Republicans reaching out to Democrats and saying, look, these are ideas we coalesced around before. Maybe we can do that again. But right now, you've got Republicans fighting, between themselves. You've got a Republican Party that, as Steve said, did walk away from things that were once Republican ideas. It's sort of like anytime Democrats go forward and embrace Republican ideas, Republicans run away from them. That goes back to the earned income tax credit, which, rewarded work and was a substitute for welfare, hopefully. Democrats love that. They expanded it. Now Republicans hate it. I mean, just time and again, this is what the Republican Party does. And so I think it's going to take another generation of Republicans who really are going back to their own shelves, as Rich knows, and saying, okay, these are some things that maybe we could work together on. These are some things in Obamacare that did work, and these are some things that we'd like to change. There doesn't seem to be any appetite for that right now. Now, if they get beaten decisively, if they start warring amongst themselves, maybe that will happen.
Rich, when I look at Republicans talking about what's wrong with healthcare law and how to fix it, I see a lot of contradictions in the discussions, because particularly what people want out of health insurance is often unrealistic. Basically, people want to go into a doctor's office and get the care that they want and pay little or nothing out of pocket and have somebody else pay for it. And there are health plans like that. They're very expensive. They used to be less expensive when healthcare was cheaper. And so Republicans talk about the need to get premiums down and then also the need to get out-of-pocket costs down. And it seems like those are contradictory ideas unless you're going to have the government throw a lot more money to subsidize the premiums, which presumably Republicans don't want to do. Ultimately, doesn't there need to be an admission here that healthcare costs money? And, so if you do the deregulatory thing that you talk about, you can do that and it'll lower premiums. But for example, you could say that they don't have to cover maternity care like they have to cover now. And healthcare wonks might say, well, maternity expenses aren't really unexpected. It's not insurance. It's a prepayment. It's a transfer from men to women. It discourages men from buying health insurance. But you go try to do that, women will look at it and say, I intend to have a baby. This doesn't cover it. It's not real health insurance.
Can I just say, as the one woman here, we are keeping the species alive. And the idea that we have to pay those costs, that we're the only ones who should bear those insurance costs, that is insane.
Right. But so, but more broadly, this is one of many trade-offs. And sort of there needs to be an admission that in considering all these trade-offs, somebody's going to have to lose on some of the trade-offs.
We've gotten away from thinking of insurance as what insurance should be, which is protection against unforeseen catastrophic events. And the whole problem with pre-existing conditions is you have people who pay for insurance when they're young and healthy, then they get sick, then they lose their job, and they lose their insurance because they lost their job, and then they can't get coverage when they've actually paid into the system, you know, for decades when they actually didn't need it. And so I do think we need to get back to the idea that insurance shouldn't pay for your routine visits to the doctor's office. They those visits should cost more than $10, but it's there to be there for you if you have a terrible accident or you know, heart disease or cancer or anything of that nature.
But what if that's not what people want? Like, people seem to want to go to the doctor's office and have somebody else pay for
it. It's not what people want, and it would be more expensive in the long term because then you're discouraging people from going and getting care when they think they need it, and then they turn out to have, we're not on television. Josh and I usually do television, so he's kind of waving his hand and saying he doesn't agree with me, and I'm looking at him.
I think the evidence is mixed on the cost of effectiveness of preventive care, but anyway, go ahead.
I think that it's cost effective, and I think that that's part of why we do it, not just to keep people happy. But yeah, I mean, it's a great feeling when you have insurance and you feel sick and you try not to go to the doctor, because most of us don't want to go to the doctor, and then you do want to, you need to, you go, and you only pay. I pay $35. I don't know who's paying $10.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Steve Clemens, what's on your mind?
Well, I have less of a rant than I have a salute to you guys, the media. This is a substantive conversation that I really enjoyed. And I had a friend, Margaret Carlson, that was just down at Mar-a-Lago, met Donald Trump, shared with her that he had just lost 10 pounds, so he wasn't going to have the Trump pie on the menu, and that he was going to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom. And she put this out in a few places, and I thought, wow, this is going to be our next news cycle, is where Trump is going to sleep in the White House. You know, sort of vapid topics. And it didn't take hold, and I sort of looked at that as something, you know, sort of optimistic and positive about the future. So less a rant than a salute to the – maybe the media is, in fact, doing the right thing.
Rich Lowry.
Four black kids in Chicago kidnapped and tortured a mentally disabled white teen. They shouted racial abuse and broadcast their crime live on Facebook, even complaining at one point that they weren't getting enough attention. God help us.
Joan Walsh.
Rich, I wasn't going to rant, but since you ranted about that, let's not racialize that, nationalize that, or anything else. Those four black kids, I guess they're black kids, they're sick. They're really messed up. They're horrible. But people are using the people are tying them to Black Lives Matter. Let's just in the new year try not to do things like that with horrible, horrible crimes by sick people.
Well, if I could just respond to that quickly, I'm not racializing this. Those kids racialized it. They're the ones pointing out the kids' race and shouting things about white people.
Fair enough.
For my rant, Donald Trump is preparing to ask the U.S. Congress to pay for the wall on the Mexican border. There's an existing law that allows the president to order the construction of a wall, but doesn't pay for the wall. Now, of course, during the campaign, he promised us over and over, you may recall, that Mexico would pay for the wall. So people have been noting that, you know, this is a bill we weren't supposed to get. Now, Donald Trump says the dishonest media is failing to report that Mexico is going to pay us back for the wall later after we pay for it up front. El Checo is in El Malo, I suppose. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Joan Walsh, and Steve Clemens. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
I'll wear pajamas.
You got pajamas.
For we know we need each other, so we better call the calling of all. Let's call the
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.